Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
Dominic, if I could start with you. You have expressed your concern about the idea of rights inflation. What does that mean, and why should we be worried about it?
So my concerns emerge from somebody who spent his entire life in progressive, socially progressive movements, and I've become concerned recently with our inability to deal with issues like poverty, the needs of Aboriginal peoples, people with disabilities, for instance. And I've come to the conclusion that part of the problem is our tendency to frame virtually all grievances as human rights issues. This is rights inflation. And this is an historically recent phenomenon that's really only begun since the 1970s. In the past, we might use frame issues around morality, religion, law, other political ideologies. It's only recently that we've come to frame it as a human rights issue. And so I've argued that we need to refocus our understanding of human rights around core rights, things like freedom of speech, assembly, association, physical security, equal treatment, etc., and consider these other issues as issues of social justice. I'm in no way suggesting that, for example, free speech is more important than hunger, that freedom of association is more important than Aboriginal people's territorial claims. Absolutely not. But the implications of rights inflation, which is why I discourage us to think of these issues as human rights violations, everything from the abstract concerns of how do we teach human rights when we have such a broad definition of human rights? Is it fueling a backlash against human rights commissions, which were never designed to deal with some of these issues? Are we diluting the evocative power of core rights when we conflate torture and physical security with education, for instance? And perhaps finally, the most important issue is this tendency that when we frame it as a human rights issue, we see the solution as a legal remedy. And I think that the law, while we've had some great victories recently around gay marriage, solicitation laws, for instance, the law is simply incapable of dealing with such complex, entrenched social problems. And I'm hoping that if we reframe these issues as issues of social justice, we can better address these social problems.
Well, let's put that to Pearl Eliadis, because Pearl, in your legal work, you specialize in human rights cases. So how do you respond to Dominic's concerns about rights inflation?
Well, in my book, I talk about the fact that human rights inflation has been a flag that has been waved by the right, and the right that would like to seek a rollback of human rights in Canada and indeed globally. I don't count Dominic in that group. I think he and I go back to 2009 when we worked together on the Canadian Museum for Human Rights and have always had a healthy exchange of views. But a couple of things to say about that. The first thing is that you can't think about rights in isolation. So when somebody is picked up outside, let's say, a public transit station because they're black, they don't understand maybe French very well, which is an incident that happened in Montreal last year, you're talking about a number of rights that are happening at the same time, that are being infringed at the same time, the right of somebody of color to be treated equally, the right to access public services, which is something that is normally cast as a social right. In Canada, we've had social and economic rights protected for 60 years, actually long before we actually had what in Canada, I think uniquely, we call civil liberties. Nobody really uses that term very much outside Canada anymore. But civil and political rights, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, as well as social and economic rights are now considered to be, and this is well established in international human rights law, not just by lawyers, but by historians, economists, our rights need to be seen together and they play out together and people need to understand that these things not only affect people's human dignity, but that when those rights are violated, that people should have remedies. Nobody is saying that we should have a situation where every type of response is either articulated as a human right or responded to as a legal claim. But in I think one anecdote I'd like to make before I close is when people first started talking about torture in the 17th century as something that was abhorrent, those claims were framed not in human rights terms. They were claimed primarily in the context of a case called Calais, in the context of religious context, whether or not one should in fact be engaged in torturing people because they had a different religion. Today we see these things differently. Human rights claims are important. They're part of the way we think about ourselves, our intrinsic humanity, and it is a well-established fact that these rights are thought about together in tandem, and to pull them apart and start to say, well, you know, we're going to have this right, but we're not going to have that right, it goes against 20, 30 years of human rights law and well-established thinking, and I think, unfortunately, I think it's regressive. Having said that, I do want to say that I think it is important. I think this is where Dominic does have a good point. We should be careful about what we're trying to call human rights. There is an established catalog of claims, and we need to be progressive about it, but without making them either frivolous or inappropriate.
Dominic, could you give us a specific example of a right that has been inflated?
Oh, absolutely. You might argue, for example, whether or not somebody has a right to special education for people who have mental disabilities, for instance. Again, this is an absolutely crucial issue, and our society must engage with this issue and provide it. But whether or not it's a human rights issue, that's where I raise some concerns, because it becomes a legal remedy to address this issue. Do we really want the courts determining the allocation of resources, for instance, on whether or not people should get, for example, water, clean water on a reserve versus students with disabilities getting access to special education programs? I mean, we only have so many resources in our society. Someone has to make the decision as to how to allocate those. And if we frame it as a human rights issue, then it becomes the courts who make that decision. Whereas I think that's something that needs to be an issue of democratic debate as our leaders. And this is what makes it so tough, because for people like Pearl and I, who share a concern with the same issues, but we do profoundly disagree on how to approach the solution, one area we really disagree on, I think, is the role of international law. For example, to answer your question about examples of rights inflation, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 had a couple of dozen human rights. Today, human rights law recognizes more than 300. The idea of the declaration of these international treaties is they're supposed to inspire people to demand equal treatment and equality. But nobody could possibly know all 300 human rights. And it seems to me bizarre to have something, so many human rights, when the human beings cannot possibly know all 300, short of somebody whose job it is to memorize all 300. We've got so many human rights now that we're in the paradoxical situation that nobody would actually know what they all are. Are these true human rights? I don't think so.
So, Pearl, what do you make of that? The concept that by expanding what we come to consider to be human rights, we're eroding the meaning of human rights?
Well, I think, regardless of what I think, the reality has been in the last 25 years precisely the opposite. And let me give you a couple of examples. On the question of a child with a disability, I'm going to ask all your listeners who are listening to this to think about children they know in their lives who have different types of learning disabilities, autism, learning disabilities, difficulty reading, and so on, and who turn to their schools for support and assistance. It has been well established in Canada for the last 60 years, that we need to treat people equally, all people equally, in government services. That right has evolved in different ways, and in the last 20 years, we've had a lot of movement around understanding what accommodation means. Accommodation meaning, how do you provide special services? How do you integrate kids into the school system? Why should children with disabilities be excluded from the types of rights that we should be thinking about?
So are you saying that by moving it into the realm of human rights, by making that the point of contention, you're speeding up the process? You're getting action from government where you might not otherwise see action?
Yes, but also more profound than that, Jim. I would say that people with disabilities are human beings, and they have rights like everyone else. And I would argue that any system, be it a government system or otherwise, that actively excludes them, as was the case in a Supreme Court of Canada decision in Moore, which is partly what Dominic's referring to, Supreme Court of Canada said, Supreme Court of Canada said, kids in this country with disabilities, kids in British Columbia, have the right to an education like everyone else, and the school needs to think about how to help them. It doesn't make the decision about how to allocate the resources, but it does make the decision that you have to include them in your programming. Sorry, Jim.
That's okay. Let's put this example specifically to Dominic. If you don't see special education for children with disabilities as a human right, where would you suggest it be dealt with?
This is an incredibly difficult issue, and I think we need to stress that we're not debating here the validity of this issue.
No.
We both believe it. It's how to best solve the problem. And I think Pearl's raised a great example. I would ask all those people, those listeners who do know somebody with a learning disability, if you think that the best use of your time, your passion, and your resources is to working your way through a court system to finally get a decision where the Supreme Court might, for instance, tell the Vancouver School Board, you have to allocate X number of dollars to make sure that Jeffrey Moore and people like him get special education. Do you think this will really solve the long-term problem of the obstacles that people with disabilities face in the school system?
So then if not that, then what?
Then they have to frame it as an issue of social justice. They have to start organizing at a local level, as a grassroots level. They need to address issues like the shame that is faced by people who experience disabilities, the stereotypes, the struggles they face on a day-to-day basis, and realize that the issue is about education and awareness and changing people's ideas rather than entrenching a legal right in a statute that will help a few people and deal with a thin solution, but never deal with the root causes of this problem, which is how we define and create disability.
So this is what you mean when you argue that in many cases human rights are a sociological rather than a legal fact.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, so many social movement organizations in this country, from gay rights groups to civil liberties groups, you go back to the 70s and the 60s, they may have gone to court four or five times in a period of 20 years. Now they expend virtually all of their energies doing court cases. And again, while there's been some similar remarkable victories, we've lost that phenomenal grassroots activism, that populism that we saw back in the 60s and 70s. And I worry that we're getting happy or we're content with these small victories.
And how do you react to that, Pearl?
Well, a couple of things to say about that. The first thing is that people who have kids with disabilities, and I've had kids in my family in that context, know full well that they never start with the legal remedy. Everybody starts trying to advocate for the school, talking to groups and organizations that support children with disabilities, trying to get psychosocial assistance. Nobody wants to go to court. I mean, it's just untrue. I litigate in this area. I work with grassroots organizations in this area. Nobody wants to start with a legal case.
You're not the first call that anyone makes.
No, and indeed, when people call me for support, what I say to them is, you know, let's not go the litigation route first. Seeing sociology and law as distinct concepts that give rise to different types of remedies is profoundly not what happens in reality. What happens is that people try to live their lives. People try to get resources for their kids. When it doesn't work, when the decisions that the decision makers make clearly and manifestly discriminate against kids based on stereotypes. Very interesting that Dominic is using legal language coming out of the human rights movement to describe how you make social justice claims. When you go out and realize that, you know what, we're not getting anywhere, the school refuses to do anything about it, and indeed in the Moore case, the school board simply refused to consider alternatives. They just shut down the diagnostic center that before was helping these kids. So nobody, the courts were not telling, you know, and this really plays to a very classical, small c, conservative concept of the role of the courts. We have a Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms in this country. We have made a democratic decision to give the courts and the legislatures the dual responsibility exactly for the allocation of resources. And when the legislature gets it wrong, as sometimes happens, the courts enter into a dialogue with society, with people, in order to make sure that that balance gets put right. And in the case of social movements and, you know, in freedom of speech cases, in the Moore case and other cases, sociological groups, the kinds of groups that Dominic studies, do come together. It's not the lawyers who are coming together. It's the groups who are coming together and saying, going before the courts and saying, we demand justice. And when a case like the Moore case gets decided, this isn't an incremental, tiny little case affecting two people. This is the Supreme Court of Canada telling every educational institution in this country how you need to think about rights. And it has profoundly changed the profile and the understanding of what these rights mean in this country. So to characterize it as a one-off thing affecting a few people, you know, people do not invest hundreds of thousands of dollars and engage with legal resources on some frivolous thing that only affects a few people. We're talking about one of the most influential court in this country, and indeed one of the most influential courts in the world that affects not only jurisprudence in this country. We should be proud of that, and we should be promoting that, and I believe that ultimately I think Dominic does support the result in that case. I know he disagrees with the way in which it was done, but human rights language helps us to frame these things, helps us to understand how to help people, and it's meaningful, and to discard it or diminish it as something separate from sociology or separate from society or separate from other claims. Of course, it's not the only game in town, but it's a game and it's an important one, and we have to recognize it as such. It's the profound right that we all have, and it's the law of this land, and it's part of the international human rights regime, which we've all signed on to.
Well, this is an interesting point, Dominic, because I think it's safe to say that in the past we've looked at the extension of rights as something to celebrate. The examples that Pearl just mentioned, women's suffrage, it would be another example. So why can't we just look at a growing list of basic rights as evidence of an evolving, inclusive society?
Well, one area that Pearl and I absolutely agree on is the extension of existing important rights to new groups of people. Another example is people who are gender nonconforming and recognizing their rights to access and other services. This is an issue I completely agree with. People with disabilities needing the ability to engage with their government. So I support the extension of core rights to new groups of people. It only becomes problematic when you start to create new human rights. As a sociologist, unlike a, for example, a legal scholar who might see an individual as kind of an abstract person who lives out society and asks themselves, okay, well, what rights does this person need to function in society? And that's how they define what a human right is. As a sociologist, I study the media, I study political debates, I study social movements, I study opinion polls, things like that. And I try to understand, where is there a consensus in our society? Where do Canadians understand to be human rights? And there is a consensus around core rights. But when we start going outside of that, again, not disputing the importance of issues like food security and housing, which are critical, but the truth is Canadians don't see these as human rights. Now, they may see healthcare and education as a legal right, but it's different from a human right. You have a legal right to sell your car, but it's not a human right. And so a lot of these issues, which are legal rights, are simply not recognized by most Canadians as human rights. And I wonder if we're imposing our conception of human rights by suggesting that they should be.
Pearl?
Well, every single human rights code in the country, which, by the way, are called human rights codes and human rights acts, all include the right to equality in a wide range of services, which could include, for example, selling your car. If I go to sell my car to somebody who refuses to deal with me because I'm black, the point is not, of course, selling the car. The point is that people are have a right to equality in certain areas that we have in Canada for 50 years recognized as close to and connected to human rights protections, employment, contracts, sales. And most Canadians, and in fact, I think if you look at polling data, which Dominic referred to, the only thing closer to Canadians' hearts than human rights and what's in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which are called human rights, not social justice, they're called human rights in this country and indeed around the world, the only thing closer to Canadians' hearts is healthcare. Repeated polls have showed this in Canada, but it isn't just about consensus. The whole reason we have courts and a rights regime and other areas of law, by the way, which are also expanding as we grow as a society, the reason we have courts and legal claims is because we do not want to have a tyranny of the majority or a tyranny of consensus. People who have different perspectives on their own lives and how they get to live their lives have the right to be different. And the fact that somebody has consensus about the fact that they don't think transgendered people, for example, should have the right to equality, there's been a pretty strong consensus against that for many years. That's starting to change. I celebrate that change.
Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us today. Fascinating conversation.
Thank
Thanks
you.
So much, Jim. Dominic, great to speak to you.
It was great to speak to you, too, Pearl. Thanks a lot. It was a
All
good
right.
follow-up from yesterday.